The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Gateless Gate of Master Wu Men. Zi Chung makes carts, the main case. Master Wei An said to a student, Zi Chung made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Take both front and rear parts away and remove the axle. Then, what will it be? The commentary. If you can immediately see through this, your eye will be like a shooting star and your spirituality like lightning. The poem. When the vividly working wheel turns, even an expert is lost. Four directions, above and below, south, north, east, and west. First, I just have to say, I really like the return of this altar bowl. That's the bowl we burned the mortgage in. That was a good day. The teacher in this koan, Wei An, not much is known about him other than he was the teacher of Master Wu Men who compiled this collection. And it's said that after saying this, that the koan is made of, he said, he held up his staff and drew a circle and then said, never fail to recognize the scale's balance. So here he's drawing upon an ancient simile, really, to try and get a sense of what does it mean that there is no abiding self. And we talked about this, well, I've referred to it many times, but recently in the intensive, I think, it's a chariot. Here, Wei An was drawing upon an historical figure in China, Zi Chung, who was said to be a master cart maker, who made a cart for the emperor that had never been seen before. It was so unusual and extraordinary. But it's the same idea. Take away the parts, front and back, axle, wheels. Now, what is it? Where's the cart? So throughout every moment that we're here in the Zendo, there is a body sitting on your seat, head, torso, arms, legs, brain, heart, lungs, liver. Within, blood flows, air moves in and out, nerves communicate heat and cold, pain and pleasure. Within, there are thoughts and emotions arise. We feel sensations. We think about the past. We think about the future. It really does seem like there is someone at the center, someone who is receiving all of this input, somebody who is organizing it, putting it into coherent ways of understanding, able to recognize this from that, someone who is basically in control of all of this, someone who knows what's going on. And it seems like this someone, this person, this being, has been at the center of this particular body for as long as we can remember, as long as we have been, all throughout our life. And it really does seem like not only is that true, but we have to rely on that person, that being, that self, that I, the Buddha said. Because they're the one who's holding everything together, making it all work. And that's a universal experience, a universally human experience. We look out and we see other beings, we see other people put together in similar ways. They're having their own experiences. We can see some of that. We can see that another person is hearing or seeing or thinking. We can hear them talk. It very much seems like there is someone there, just like there's someone here. And so within that universal experience that we can, pretty easily probably go through our whole lives never questioning, never thinking out, it seems pretty inarguable. Yuan presents us with this question. When you remove the head, the arms, the legs, your brain, heart, and lungs, when the thoughts and sensations and emotions lie still, then what will there be? What happens to this someone, this being? The Buddha said, from the perspective of samsara, delusion, we experience everything in terms of I am this, this is me, this is mine, what we identify as, our sense of self, what we possess. And when we identify with something, we are sort of anti-identifying with the opposite of that thing. If I'm a good person, that's my someone is a good person. I'm not a bad person. When Yuan says, take the parts away, remove the axle, what does that mean, to remove? When we chant, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, what does no mean? I have eyes, I have ears. And so we look, we reclaim our capacity to look, or to see clearly, to see directly. And in order to do that, we encounter everything that makes that difficult. Beliefs, ideas, assumptions, projections, attachments, all of the stuff that basically makes session challenging. And very importantly, we have to develop the ability and the trust really to go beyond making meaning of everything. Something arises, you feel something, you think something, what does it mean? And it's usually, it's personal. What does it mean about me? It might not, we might not express it that way exactly, but if we trace it back, and of course, people come to the Dharma for many different reasons. For some, it's meditation, it might be community, it might be certain aspects of the teachings, wanting to develop compassion. It might be enlightenment without really having much sense of what that means. And those are all certainly part of Buddha Dharma and certainly valuable and valid and will certainly impact and improve our lives. But the teachers, going back to the Buddha, have always hoped that whatever our initial impulse is or seeking is based in, that we will come to wonder about the connection between this self and my unhappiness, between this self and the tenacity of my habits, of my karma that I create, that I keep creating, that we'll begin to really deeply inquire and want to understand what is the connection between this self that Buddhism teaches and holds so primary and all of the pain and confusion and misery and injustice and unnecessary sadness in our world. When that begins to happen, things change. Zizhung was a master cart maker. In the commentary, Shibayama makes a point of talking about how as a master cart maker, you know, with that skill, that he might very well have, in building the cart, have a very strong concentration, might enter into what we might think of as samadhi. And so Shibayama asks the question, can we regard an expert rider, horse rider, or an expert cart maker, or anybody who does anything with a great degree of skill as realized, as enlightened? And he says, no. When one puts one's soul and body into one's work, often they will be in some state of concentration or samadhi when they are at work, where they forget themselves. They're no longer thinking, I am doing this. They're no longer thinking about the skill that's required, about what the next action is going to be. They're just completely immersed, that the skill is that integrated. And in that way, they seem to transcend the distinction between subject and object, the person and what they're doing. He says, but this kind of unity, while it has its own value and beauty, and is certainly to be admired, is limited because in most cases, it is limited to the particular aspect of their work. Dr. Roshi used to tell the story about a student at CCLA who was a very famous keyboard player, harpsichord player, and that when he sat down to play, he was, you know, like transcendent. And then he would finish and get up and trip and fall and drop things and so as a way of making that point, that it's limited to that particular action. That's where the concentration has been honed, but it's not translating. And that's why we practice mindfulness and deepening that concentration continuously, right? So it's not restricted to the cushion. And then to understand that samadhi itself, though important and opening doors and transformative in a certain way, is not yet insight. So a person can lose that sense of self in an action, but still be very much attached to a sense of self. In other words, forgetting in those moments, everybody's had such moments where we're not, you know, conscious or aware of that sense of self in some moment. But it's not the same as having actually seen directly that the self is empty. I was thinking about when Chikihara came, you were here, yeah, who painted those incredible ox herding pictures downstairs and some of the other paintings that we have. He showed up one day. He had lived here for a month or so, I think, in the very early years before we got here, and had done some of those paintings. But we were years later. It couldn't have been too late, because I remember all of the residents fit around just a couple of tables. There weren't that many of us. But he showed up one day with two or three of his senior students. And Dada Roshi was there, and he had his video camera, so he was filming them while they did some examples. And so each of his students sat down and did some paintings while they at sitting at the dining room table. We were surrounding them, and it was amazing. I mean, just watching them paint was like, I'd never seen anything like that. And also, you don't usually get a chance to watch art being created, right? And of course, that kind of art happens within minutes. You know, it's begun and finished within minutes. So you can watch this whole beginning with a blank page. And the first series of strokes that I would watch, I would think, I have no idea where this is going. Like, what is that? And then suddenly you'd see an eye or a shoulder, and it was just, this world would just come into being. It was amazing. So we were watching these senior students who were much younger than Chikihara Sensei, who was quite old. He was a Buddhist priest. And I was thinking, that's amazing. Like, how much better could he be? And then he sat down and started painting. And I wouldn't even know how to try and describe what that experience was of watching him. It was kind of transcendent. There was something that was happening and that was inexpressible to see how he moved. It was just so easy. But Shimoyama is making the point that as, you know, wonderful, beautiful as that is, there is something more. I was going to, during the next session, start drawing from the wisdom chapter of Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life. But I decided to start this session so I have more opportunities to draw from that. And in that chapter, which is really the culmination of the whole text, all of these other paramitas, based in prajna, and now in this final chapter, he is speaking directly about prajna itself. And in that, there's a series of verses where a question is asked. How does realizing that all phenomena are like illusions free us from our delusions? After all, a magician who creates an illusion of a person can still develop attachment to that illusory person. It's like an author of a book, of a novel, starting to believe in a character that they've created. I remember reading years ago that in the early years of TV, it probably still happens, but I think it was Dr. Kildare, a very old, early, and people would come up to the actor on the street and start asking him the medical questions, you know. I remember, wasn't it Brad Pitt that was in that movie about 7 years in Tibet with the Dalai Lama? And I was listening to an interview where the interviewer said, what was it like to play the Dalai Lama? And he said, look, I'm a grown-up who puts on makeup for a living. I have no idea what it's like to be the Dalai Lama, which was nice. He wasn't being fooled by that illusion. So why does realizing that all things are empty free us of our delusions? A very good question. Illusion, of course, is something that appears, we see something, but we misperceive it. We see it as something that it's not. So a mirage is a frequently used example. Or that you see a rope, you know, laying in the corner of a dark room and you react because it's a snake. You react because you think it's a snake, but then you realize it's just a rope. So we see something, but it's being misperceived, misinterpreted by the senses. And so there's a kind of a deception. It's not willfully, we're not willfully deceiving ourselves, but our senses, in a sense, and remember the mind is one of the senses, is deceiving us. And these are just standard definitions, that there's a tension in an illusion between that illusion and reality. Very interesting. There's a tension. And so Shantideva's answer is, well, this is because the magician has not abandoned their deluded tendency to grasp at inherent existence. Thus, when they behold the illusory person that they've conjured, their tendency to perceive that person's emptiness is weak. And it was in a part of their mind, they know it's an illusion, but that part is weaker than the part of them that believes that things, that illusion, actually exists. By developing familiarity with the view or the experience of emptiness, Shantideva said, we will eventually abandon grasping at inherent existence, especially by meditating on the emptiness of emptiness. Nothing has an inherent existence. So in realizing the emptiness of things, we then need to realize that emptiness itself is not something. Then Shantideva says, we will come to abandon grasping of all things. And this is a very nice way of describing training. That we, in a sense, begin within all of our illusions. We see things, we hear things, we taste, we touch, we think. We create mental images in our mind that we react to. We create projections about ourselves and other things. Maybe you've had a few this session. Maybe you've had some about your neighbors or other things that have been happening. Something happens, you see it, and the mind creates a world. There's a kind of knowing. I know what's going on. What, you know, what's going on with that person? Why did they do that? I know why they did that. What's wrong with them? And so there's an infusion of reality into this illusion. And when there is no tension, then we're more immersed within samsara. It's not an illusion to us. It's just reality. It's the only show in town. It's all there is. What would I question? There it is. When there's a tension, that's a good thing. That tension is bodhicitta, is recognizing things are not as they seem. And there is something there. And so as we practice, what? Sitting, minding your own business. So your practice is your business, right? That's the business that you mind. Mind your own business. Stay with that practice. And then illusions start appearing. We don't necessarily experience them that way or think of them that way because our experience of anything else is weak or non-existent. That's all we've got. And so we get caught. We get caught in the emotion because it seems very real and the emotion is about me. So it seems very personal. And if I perceive that as a threat, then it's really hard, right? Because the center of my universe is under threat. If it's something that's nice, pleasant, exciting, then that's good. And that also seems like something about me. But it doesn't last. Shantideva says, when it's said that no thing exists, this means that truly existent things do not exist. And this is just something that in studying the Dharma, we just have to be aware of. That very often the teachings will seem to say, this does not exist, period. As though the teachings seem to be saying, this is not there. So this kutz does not exist means it does not exist inherently. That there is no place or part of this in which stick exists. But there it is. So we just have to understand that code in a sense. So Shantideva says, well then how could a mind grasping at inherent existence of emptiness remain when the basis for such a misconception, that is grasping at inherent existence of emptiness, has been removed when we realize that self and all aspects, the aggregates, and other phenomena, when no thing has its own independent existence in a kind of intrinsic quality that is permanent, that exists by itself, that emptiness itself, that nature, self-nature of all things, which is empty, that has no existence in and of itself, it's not a thing. Then if that's true, then how could the mind continue to grasp? Habit. Those habits are still very strong, and they will arise. One old teacher I was reading said that he has seen directly and has deep faith in the emptiness of all things, but when he stubs his toe, he's in pain, right? I'm in pain. And in that moment of pain, that sense of I is at the ready. And there are teachings that talk about the fear that can be, that can arise when we consider or reflect on or actually are practicing taking away the front and the rear parts, removing the axle, letting go more, going into silence, going into stillness. You know, when we're struggling with that, with silence, it's a good thing to just reflect on, right? Is there an element of just being anxious about just being silent? Is there an anxiety about that within ourselves, by ourselves? Is there an anxiety about that in being silent with another or with others? Have we not really experienced silence so that we understand how wonderful it is, how important it is within practice? And so the fear that we can encounter, it's very common when a person is letting go and really getting into deeper states of meditation during Sesshin, and they're experiencing themselves, their mind, their zazen in a deeper way, and there's a real more deeper falling away, that it's not at all uncommon that anxiety will arise. And that the person will often activate their mind. They'll start thinking. I've talked to people at home who didn't really understand what was happening, and it kind of freaked them out, and they just got up. And they like didn't want to go near the cushion. It's like something happened there. I don't know what that was. Shanti Davis says, if you're going to be afraid of something, then by all means, be afraid of that which is the principal cause of your suffering. Be afraid of that. But since meditation and all of its stages is helping to liberate you from suffering, why should you be afraid of this? I remember thinking this in my early years and thinking, you know, is this some sort of Buddhist non-chemical drug trip? You know, like am I inducing some state? Like I really wondered about that, you know. Like is it a different version in a way of the same old thing? It's just I'm just going to create a different state of mind. But then when I reflected and I thought about what am I doing in Zazen? What is Zazen? I thought I'm not inducing something. In a way, that's what I'm doing all the time. What I'm trying to do is stop inducing something. Stop creating something. Not manufacture some state of mind. And that really helped me to think, so then if that's what I'm doing, that is what I'm doing, and I'm coming closer to what is already there, I shouldn't be afraid of that, because it's already there. So whatever it is I might be reacting to is already there. I'm just coming closer. Shanti Davis said, if there were a truly existent I, self, it would make sense to be afraid of letting it go. Yeah, we'd be in trouble if that really was true, that is who we are, and that's who we need to be, and that's who is making the whole performance happen, and so you can't lose that. But Shanti Davis said, but since there is no truly self-existing permanent I, who is there to be afraid of? The teeth, your hair, your nails, they're not yourself. Your bones or blood, your body's fat or sweat are not the self, nor are your lungs or liver. If you have a hair to pluck out of your head and you look at it, it's your hair, right? You might really identify with that hair. It's an important part of you, but when you look at it, it's like, is that you? Is that Shugan? And Shanti Deva is saying, and this is a traditional meditation practice, look at any of those constituent parts that we identify with, that we depend upon. Can we find ourself in them? So he says, so then if you remove all the aggregates, what will you be? What are you at this very moment? And so think about that in a moment where you're feeling fearful, or you're sad, or you're angry, or you're lonely, or you're having a memory, or you're anticipating something, you're wanting something, where actually do those abide? Those can be very strong. They can fill our whole body and mind. But where is you in any of those arisings? They seem to belong to you. They're happening in you somehow. We're experiencing it. It's like you're not experiencing the sadness across the room. It's in you, but at the same time, it seems to be something apart from you that is doing something to you. It wasn't there before, and you were fine. You were minding your own business. Now it's arisen, and it's doing something to me. It's impacting me. It's overwhelming me. It's causing me to have all these proliferating thoughts, cascading emotions. It certainly seems to exist and have its own power. And that basically is the sense of a self, is something that has its own power, its own being, it's autonomous. When somebody is criticizing you, or you're perceiving what they're saying as criticism, or somebody is giving you praise, right? Who is it that elevates? And who is it that deflates? Where is that? So the teachings say, having, you know, an encounter in these teachings, that all things are like clouds, dreams, illusions, a flash of lightning in a summer sky, a bubble in a stream, a ghost, that all objects are empty in every respect. Why then did the Buddha talk about the essential nature, the true nature of a being, what we call Buddha nature, right? And in Buddhism, there's a kind of tension there because a Buddha nature can sound like something. Okay, everything is empty of any intrinsic nature, but I've got Buddha nature, so I've still got something. There's a kind of tension. And of course, that's not how Buddha nature is to be understood. And so the teachings say that the Buddha taught this to help us relinquish five flaws or five traps. Faithlessness, that we can have no faith in our own basic nature. We can think, you know, who am I kidding? Enlightenment? Come on. I mean, I'm not a bad person, but I'm just me, right? I don't have faith that I could do that. And particularly when I see myself continue to, like, go down the rabbit hole and, you know, get into trouble. And so the teaching of Buddha nature has helped to help us develop that faith, which has to mean not just in an abstract sense or for everybody else, but you. That you have Buddha nature and you have the capacity to realize it. The fact that you're here basically is testimony to that. That it was taught so that we would not have contempt for others that we might think of as inferior. Because everything is endowed with Buddha nature. And so it's important to cultivate that understanding, that faith, so that we understand when we inflict inferiority on somebody else, when we put them into a smaller, shorter, tighter, imperfect box, that we see that the teaching of Buddha nature is to help us not do that. There may be something going on there. Maybe a person is acting badly. But that's not their nature. The teaching of Buddha nature helps us to keep from clinging to what is illusion, illusory. In other words, it sort of keeps helping us to come back to what is true. It helps to keep us from depreciating true Dharma. In that sense, it keeps holding up for us what is the the most important, sort of the ultimate teaching of Buddhism, right? That settling our mind and opening our hearts and practicing within a sangha, doing meaningful work, wanting to do good in the world, all of these things are part of the path. But that the essence is the essential medicine to deal with the essential illness is to liberate ourselves from that sense of self that we cling to, which is the fifth trap that Buddha nature helps us with, which is to help us not excessively attach to ourself. I thought that was very interesting. Not excessive attachment. A little bit. That is to give courage to those who otherwise might not be drawn to the teachings. This was a teaching by an ancient master, Maitreya, to give courage. And, you know, we live in a time where insecurity and self-doubt is sort of part of our societal and cultural manufacturing, right? I think we're very much taught and bred to not trust ourselves, not believe in ourselves. But these teachings go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, so it's not a new thing to get trapped in those things, to not have faith in ourselves, to hold others in contempt, to cling and attach to what is not real, to depreciate or undervalue or not really see the Dharma for what it is, to excessively attach. None of this is new. When the vividly working wheel turns, even an expert is lost. Four directions above and below, south, north, east, and west. Why would a true expert be lost? An expert's supposed to be in control, in charge of things. They should be anything but lost. There's being lost within our thoughts, our emotions, which means to be overwhelmed, to be seduced, deluded by them, to see them as something self-existing. No intimacy. There's being lost within false views and beliefs. Oh, yeah. Fair bit of that. Fair amount of that going around. And there's being lost within righteousness and unexamined attachments. Yeah, fair amount of that going around. And we see the more these aspects of our delusion, the stronger they get, the more dangerous they become, we become, the more danger we create. And isn't that interesting? It's sad, it's terrifying, but isn't it interesting? Delusion we think of as, well, it's just something I'm doing with my mind. You know, it can seem sort of abstract. I'm just deluded. Just attaching to things that aren't real. But that the stronger that is, the more convinced, the more unreflected, unexamined, it actually becomes toxic. It becomes toxic to the system in which it's happening. And all too often, that toxicity is put out there. It's just delusion. It's just a way of seeing. And our impulsive consciousness, the kleshas, all of these just universal aspects of ourself. But when they get too strong, which can be all the time in some people's lives, hell beings, and in moments for others, we all have moments, but the degree of those moments, how strong they are, how deeply lost we are in them. And so we shouldn't just have respect for the Dharma, we should actually have respect for our delusion. And not in the sense of, you know, honoring it, but in the sense of respecting how powerful it is, which within the Bodhisattva path is our urgency. It's why this is important. And why it's not just important for my own well-being, why it has to be for myself and others, why I want it to be for myself and others. When you're deep in the mountains, when you're deep within one moment, what Dogen calls one undivided activity, one action, one awareness. In that moment when you let go of the map, you let go of the skill, you let go of practice, trying, of consciousness, at that moment, what are you? Where are you? Even an expert is lost. All four directions. You know, there's nothing abstract and although about this Dharma. And while there is, over the centuries, has been much philosophy and philosophers on Buddhism, most of the great ones were great practitioners. They weren't just philosophers. But whatever, all of these teachings, from beginning to end, are about human lives. That's it. That's it. And the very particular way we can have a human life, when we open our eye, when we open our hearts. And, you know, you could say, well, wouldn't it be nice if it was easier? So let's, you can write a story about that, right? And then you'll have a story. It isn't hard. We're the ones who are hard. We are hard within ourselves. That's why Dogen said the human mind is hard to change. It's hard to change in the path moving towards wisdom and compassion simply because it's been moving in other directions for so long. But, you know, everybody who's arrived at this, at the door of this Zendo has encountered things that have been hard and sometimes have put huge amounts of time and energy sustained in things that were difficult. So, what's hard is samsara. That's what's hard. So, you don't realize how easy this is. So let's appreciate. And I know sometimes it can be hard when we're tired, when our legs hurt, when our mind is jumbled. But why is that hard? Why is any one of those states hard? When we identify with it. When it's just a state, it's not permanent, it's not you, it doesn't belong to you, it's not a judgment of whether you are a good or bad person or practitioner, it's just a moment that is arising in a particular form. Tiredness is just a particular state of mind. That's all. When we see it that way, when we don't identify, then it's just this moment. And when that begins to settle in, things are not the same.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.